Okay. What we often want to do, we've represented this object with a chain code and computed the difference, is we really do want it to be independent of rotation. So rotate it, not physically, rotate the difference chain code and make it the smallest possible number. Okay, so the idea is, first of all, you've got the difference. That's the relative directions. Okay, that's the order is not important, provided that we come up with a rule for always picking the same starting point. And the idea for the same starting point is we always rotate it to make it the smallest number. So you could have a chain code representation. This could be with an 8 code and a stop sign. And you would always then have to get an octagonal code. But you see, we take the difference, and we're always rotating this. And you see, for this one, we can make it smaller. So the idea is these are shape numbers. They represent the difference chain code. And as long as you've sampled it well, they're rotationally invariant. How's that for interesting? You can, now, one of the things that you have to decide is how you approach generating a chain code for something. And one of the first things you have to do is decide how large a grid is that you're going to represent an object with. In this case, they wanted a 12-digit shape number, but I actually 18, but I suspect what they did more is they actually said, oh, these are going to be pair-like objects, and I want a 6x3 representation. One of the things that often happens is you fit a maximum rectangle. Okay, and there are all kinds of ways to fit bounding boxes to objects. So we fit a bounding box to it, 6x3, because we want to get an 18-digit chain code. Obviously, by the way, we pick our axes so that they correspond to the principal axis box. And then we identify the segments on the that are the closest. Okay? This part's hard. You know, picking there and there. And, you know, this one would be a hard one to pick right here, but you've got to have a 90-degree transition here so that you can get down to this. So this step right here, from here to here, is the hard one. Okay, that's some pretty sophisticated programming. Once you have the chain code, then you just do the difference, and then you rotate it to get as many zeros in the beginning as possible. Usually that's adequate. Usually you don't have to worry about fine distinctions in the number. But that's one way of doing it. It's not the only way. Here's going to be a really interesting way. Okay? What we do in this one, and, you know, we were talking while some of you were over getting your food about some of the issues that you get into with the size of an object, rotation of an object, translation. Well, there's a really neat idea. Take samples on the boundary of an object. Now, this looks like a letter C. Okay? What you can do is, if this is an X and a Y axis, we're going to represent every boundary point as a complex number. So, for example, this would be X naught plus J Y naught. Represents that point. This one would be X1 plus JY1. And what you can do, which is really neat, is if you have them in order, okay, if the SKs are your complex numbers, you can do a discrete Fourier transform. Actually, it's bad. I'm using 2K, big and little. You can do a 2D, I'm sorry, that's a 1D Fourier transform, and that is a description of the complete boundary. And that's really interesting. Because, well, there's a whole variety of things, but let's stop and think for a moment. You see, we put a complex number in here. This is sort of a little bit like the one the last time where we discovered that if you project and then multiply each element by a complex number, we could come up with the velocity at which objects in the image were moving. Here, by assigning each one to a complex number and taking the Fourier transform, we have all kinds of really interesting things. How do you do image compression? JPEG. You just chop off the high-frequency terms of the Fourier transform. That can be done here. If I've got the Fourier transform of the boundary, and maybe I have 100 points, I get 100 frequency terms. But the idea, low frequency to high frequency. Do I need the high frequency terms? Low pass filter, the shape. Okay. Interesting concept. Here's what you can do. Here is a simple square, 64 points. You would then have 64 frequency components in the Fourier domain. To reconstruct it, how about if I just took the first two terms and then did an inverse Fourier transform? See, what I'm saying is, once I have the coefficients in the Fourier space, just pick a couple of them. Typically, my spectrum in the Fourier space might look like that, well, of course, and then come back. But the idea is that usually the frequency terms are going to go down. And if you want the basic shape, you see, this is shape now. It's different than the Fourier transforms that we did before. It's of the contour. So there's what it looks like with two terms, a circle. We add more terms, and it's just like if we were trying to reconstruct a pulse with a finite number of terms. As we get more and more terms, notice that the corners are starting to shape up. And when we get to the full, well, 62 terms, close enough, you see you actually get square corners. Now, you may say, well, I had to really, really get a lot of terms there to get anything useful. But with a lot of objects, you don't. You can do recognition with just a couple terms. If the first five terms match, that might be good. This is contours, no color, simple measure, okay, of the shape. And it turns out that there's all kinds of properties. Not everyone in here, I know, has a background in Fourier transforms, but it turns out that it only adds, well, we can do it invariant to rotation. Translation shows up as a simple term. And scaling, same thing. The transform scale. So it's great. You get a small object, you get a small transform. Remember earlier when we were looking at how, you know, Fourier transforms of the 2D images, if I rotated the image, the principal axis the Fourier transform would follow it. There's all kinds of really great things that you can do here. Now, other things that you can do. Let's suppose that you have a boundary of something. Okay? Now, this could be, this really, we don't know what in the world is a boundary of. It's just something. Okay? Do the following. Take this line segment. All you know is that you have a line that goes from A to B. Rotate it and put it down on the axis. Okay? And usually there's a procedure for normalizing stuff or whatever. Okay? And then what you actually plot here is this is not actually the shape. What this is it's a histogram of, if I drew this line here, the distances of the stop sign is not necessarily very appropriate. But if you had some fancier contour that you want to recognize, then this could be very, very good. You could have a very complicated or a very long line with a lot of points, but you might only want to choose 10, 20 different bins for a histogram. So you can, again, reduce the dimension of the representation. By the way, if you have a histogram, you can compute average, you can compute moments, variance, whatever. This thing has all kinds of statistical properties. All of those, as individual numbers, can be used as features for pattern recognition. You see, what we're doing now is we're trying to take pictures, curves, shapes, areas, and convert them into numbers, which inputs, for example, to neural networks, decision rules, whatever. The point is, we have to take an image of numbers. You can do a fun thing. I actually think this one's rather cool. The ratio of white to dark is a measure of energy usage. So you can take it to any grid size, and you can lay any mesh that you want on top of this, and from satellite photos, you can estimate electrical energy use. You don't have to go in and read meters, do anything. How's that for a nice, nifty way? That this is the way people that analyze satellite pictures think. You know, not weather people, but there are people that analyze crops, water. It's amazing what can be done. They can just look at it from orbit and tell you, you know, what crops you're growing, how well they're doing that year, and how far they are away from harvesting. And they can also estimate the tonnage per acre, all from space or aerial observation. Now, this is something we have not done. This is really getting into 530 material, topology. And it turns out, all topology is related to the it turns out, if you stop to think about it, that rotation, scale, anything. For example, I have two holes inside an object. I can rotate it, I can stretch it, I can do all kinds of things, but I always have two holes inside an object. That is sort of invariant. And it turns out that this gets into a whole class of things called computer vision. And we get very concerned about topology in computer vision. And one of the things that we have is Euler. And it's the number of connected components minus the number of holes. The number of connected components you can think of is that, in this case, just a basic background. There's one. There's two holes. Okay. So that has an Euler number of minus one. Here, we have a region. It's got three connected regions. No holes. And I won't get to but one of the things that we want to do is we want to curve. And this gets a terrible process to help you and still preserve the original shape. Now, that really shape. Now, a great deal of insight into complexity of objects, other ways of representing them. It gets into graph theory. If you go on, some of you, if you go on for your PhD, will make sure you take the course in graph theory. So you start to represent everything as a graph. And technically, the whole area of pattern recognition is a graph. In other words, a very, very complicated object would have graph. And if I want to recognize something from a little piece of it, it would have just a fraction of the total graph, and I'd have to map. topologically. Again, that's one scope of this. Now, here's a fun little example. And we actually did this before. I haven't figured out how to apply this to the mobile robotic vision analysis. But this is an infrared image of Washington. This is just simply threshold. Okay, and you notice the problem with a simple threshold. This problem you're going to get into if you use this approach on analyzing road surfaces and stuff. You're going to get little spots all over. Now, some of you have done things like erosion to get rid of a lot of little components and stuff. But what you can also do is you can do connected component analysis. And so, for example, we actually did this earlier. Chapter 9, you may have remembered, we were looking at the bones in a piece of chicken. Okay? And we simply picked each white pixel in the thresholded image, and what we wanted to do is find out which ones were connected. And it turns out this is now one large connected object. Every single pixel is connected, and it's the largest one. It lets out all of these little ones. Okay? Now what can you do? And this gets into geographical information systems and stuff. Do a skeleton on this. If you do a skeleton on this, what you can actually now do is you have a single line, and you can go along and you can measure, for example, the length of rivers, length of roads. You actually now can calculate measures. It would have been much harder if you had wide objects. Tiny bit about texture. This is an example of the types of texture. Okay, smooth, coarse, regular. A common technique is we might look at the Fourier transform. Fourier transforms of these are going to be very different. Low frequency, high frequency, discrete. You'll see a lot of peaks in this spectrum. These may or may not have any peaks. So, again, not necessarily applicable to our driving, but could be used for a lot of things. Other ways of talking about texture. If you have a region, for example, if I have nothing but grayscales, I can compute histograms for each region that I'm interested in. And if you take a look back here, I have three identified regions. How about if I take the histogram for each? I can compute mean gray level. I can compute standard deviation of gray level. Now, we can get into some new measures. And these are partial to the measure of texture. For example, R is a measure of smoothness, and it's 1 plus 1 over 1, whoops, 1 minus, 1 plus the variance squared. People have variance. You can do third moments. Maybe you don't remember from when I was talking about statistics. What does the third moment tell you? Okay, the second moment tells you how wide it is. The third moment tells you if it's shifted to the left or the right. So it tells you how far shifted it is. There's uniformity, there's entropy, there's all kinds of these measures that you can get into. This next topic is a computer vision topic. By the way, I'm not pushing my course 531 since we haven't offered it in about 10 years. But we might offer it in the next year or two. Okay. Grammars. Anyone ever hear of a grammar in any of their courses? Okay. Grammars are nothing more than rules for constructing objects. And you can get very fancy rules. You can get very simple rules. The idea is that you usually start with a symbol. And then you have rules for constructing stuff. These are for regular textures. Okay? And so, for example, this is a rule here that my starting symbol is replaced by A, and the starting symbol. And in this case, this is going to be A. Okay, so in terms of letters, and if I start with S, I replace it by AS, okay, what happens? I replace the S by AS, I replace the S by AS, and that's just a rule for generating a sequence of circles. Okay, but if we add a couple more rules to it, okay, for example, we might have, and I'll tell you what these are in a moment. And you can do some pretty amazing things with these grammars. B is a circle down. And C is a circle on the left. Okay, and what we want to do is we're going to start out the same way. We're going to apply the same rule that we had over there. Okay, and how about if we generate an AAAS? Okay, but how about now, why don't I take my S okay, let me just think here for a moment. Because I've got my three A's. I want to move down, and I've got a rule. Oh, S can go to BA. Okay. I was looking for my rule, and B is down. Okay. And I'm doing a geometric interpretation. Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. That would be a BS. Okay. Then, I'm sorry, BA. Then we've got the A, which goes to BS. Okay. Then we've got the S, which can go to BA. Then we're going to do an A. Let's see. What do I want next? I want a... You know, I actually did that wrong. I did too many B's. I have it going over, 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 down, 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 and I'm going to get a hollow object. What I want it to do is move down, okay, and then do a left. So that's CA. Now I take that A and generate a CA, okay, and I could keep going, but you see what I'm doing is the first three generate it, my first shape, I move down and I do that. I now have generated two to the left, and what I want to do is move down, and I can make it generate regular shapes. Now, this doesn't look like much, but for example, you can do some really, really fancy textures with grammars. For example, alligator skin can be perfectly duplicated and described by a grammar, and that's a pretty complicated thing with overlapping scales and stuff. You can do other things. 2D Fourier spectrum. And anyone recognize this? It's a standard form of sheet metal decorative that you can buy in lots of stores to, for example, make covers for your radiators in your homes and apartments. It's a decorative sheet metal. But the point is, here's what the 2D Fourier spectrum of it looks like. Now, notice that we didn't do any log transform to try and brighten it or anything, but you can see that it's got some very simple frequency components. For textures, we might do something completely different. Instead of expressing our Fourier spectrum that way, which is a 2D and X and Y, what we've actually done here is actually pretty neat. We can take circles of different radii, okay, and compute Fourier transforms around circles. So, for example, I could take all the points in the image and compute the Fourier transform around that circle. And that's what this kind of stuff is. This is a circular transform in that texture. This one is a radial. Okay, along a line. So you can do transforms now, and these show the texture in different ways. With texture, you might want to be classifying a type of surface or a type of area. Usually you have to somehow identify the texture first. Okay, this is very different. Anyone recognize this one? It's sort of the chain link that's often in front of a fireplace. You know, the wire mesh that's used to keep sparks from flying out. This is much more rectangular. And this one makes sense if we would do the circular transform. This one has peaks at multiples of 90 degrees. Lots of energy there, lots of energy there. If you go along diagonals, you don't pick up much. Now, I'm obviously skipping a lot with texture simply because we don't have a lot of time to spend on it. Now, here is something which may be useful to you stop sign people. Okay? Moments. And I'm not going to do all the algebra. If you take a look at your textbook, the algebra for moments covers 3 pages. And the author says in the middle of it that the derivation is beyond the scope of this book. Okay? And it's an amazing amount of algebra. But what moments are getting into is if we have an object, what we can do is we can calculate moments. For example, the first mean. Now, these can be regions which are exclusively the object, or they can be regions which bound an object. Okay? But we're going to be using the double subscript. That'll represent the first moments. Okay? In general, I'm going to need mu 02 and mu 20. Okay? And what I'm going to have to do, double sum, let me make sure I got that backwards. That's X, that's Y. Okay, remember back when I talked about statistics? Okay, for the mean, we don't multiply the function by anything. For the second moment, with respect to x, it's x minus x bar squared. So this is the second central moment. We could do the same thing with regard to y. We can normalize these. Actually, I should use standard notation. We can normalize them by the square of the mean. There's another normalized moment. This looks like a lot of work. However, it turns out that if you calculate a bunch of those measures, and if you think about it, they're not very complicated measures. And in fact, the statistical routine will give you them all for your little region. What you can come up with, and this is the part that is absolutely beyond the scope of this course, this is the first invariant moment. That is constant, irregardless of rotating the object, reflecting the object, translating the object. This is constant for that shape. And that's really, really very neat and very powerful. Now, it's only on shapes, you know, black against white, white against black, or, you know, a color. Here's a very, very interesting thing. There are seven shape numbers. Okay? Here's the shape number for the original image. Cut the image in half. The shape numbers don't change very much. Flip the image around an axis. And in fact, this is not just one axis. This is around the origin. You can mirror it. And look at that. The numbers don't change very much. Rotate it a little bit. Rotate it a lot. The shape numbers don't change. So if, for example, you computed the shape number for a stop sign, and not the shape number, but you computed an invariant moment, you know, this is just black and white imaging now. You know, and you compute it. You just had black, or let's say white on black. That's it. You thresholded it. You compute all of those moments. And you could compute the seven moments and say, and we'll get into decision rules in a moment, which one of these does it look similar to my known stop sign? So there are ways of fairly accurately recognizing shapes. Now, this is one of my favorites. How many people know how to use eigenvectors and eigenvalues? Okay, don't worry. It sounds very difficult. It isn't. Knowing how to mathematically compute the eigenvalues in eigenvalues and eigenvectors of a matrix can be complicated. But those are math routines. LIMPAC, MATLAB, anything. It can compute them. The thing is, what can we do with them? And they're really great for a number of things. This background. I can define a vector for each element in an image. Okay? And for example, let's suppose I have a red image, a green image, and a blue image. Okay? And I take the corresponding pixels in each one. That's my little X vector. How about if I'm working from a satellite or an aircraft? What if I have multispectral images? Near infrared, far infrared, red, middle green, middle blue, ultraviolet, things like that. Or it could even be one's visible and one's infrared. There's all kinds of ways, but I have a vector at each point which is made up of the corresponding pixel from each one of my images. Okay? I can then compute for all of those a mean vector and a covariance matrix. Okay, this we've talked about before. This is just a reminder of how it set things up. If we can get the covariance matrix, and we can get the mean. Okay, and this is now, we've got, let's take a simple case, red, green, blue, red, green, blue. Each triple, or each vector, and maybe it's 256 by 256, I'd have an awful lot of these vectors. I could compute the mean vector, and I could compute this covariance matrix. Now, here's the part that's new. Anyone know what a Hotelling transform is? Okay, don't worry. That's what it is. Y equals AX minus M. That's it. I subtract off the mean, and I multiply it by A. Basically, I'm rotating it, if you know vectors. That's it. This we've already computed. The question is, what is A? A is the matrix of eigenvectors. I know, that sounds horrible. A is the matrix of eigenvectors of this matrix. The covariance matrix, you just compute this in MATLAB, and then you run another routine that computes the eigenvectors of this matrix. I'm not going to get into the mathematics of eigenvectors, but what's really useful about them? Well, what I've done is the eigenvectors, usually we represent them vertically. I represent all of my vectors vertically. This simply means I've put them horizontal. Here's the really neat thing. Okay? This takes the original vectors x, which might be red, green, blue, and translates them, for example, into three new colors, whatever they are. They're combinations of red, green, and blue. And here's what's really neat about them. The matrix of mean values is zero. All of them are centered around the origin. They're all zero mean. That's interesting. And there is a covariance matrix. Since these are still random variables, they're translations of the original. Here's what's really neat. They're a rotation of the original vectors, okay, of the original matrix, covariance matrix, CX. And it's got some really neat properties. This transformation makes the Y's independent of each other. They're independent variables. They're uncorrelated. There are only diagonal elements. And it turns out the diagonal elements are the eigenvalues. All of your routines will give you the eigenvalues in order. Largest, next largest, etc. It turns out, just like you did a discrete cosine transform to do JPEGs, what you've simply done here is this is the equivalent almost of a Fourier transform. With transform, for example, I was using RGB. Let's make it 12 different colors. Okay, make it complicated. Okay, I've transformed it to 12 different colors. They're all orthogonal to each other. Here's the real neat thing. This is what eigenvalues and eigenvectors are all about. I can invert that transform and get right back to the X. Okay, so you're going to say, okay, he's crazy. He came up with these matrices, he computed them all, he rotated the variables, and then he rotates them right back to get the original. What's the advantage of doing that? Well, here's what it's all about. What happens if I don't use all the eigenvectors? What if I, instead of 12, what if I do the first two? What's the resulting x hat look like? This is like taking a discrete cosine transform and chopping off all the high-frequency terms, except instead of frequency, we're dealing with correlation and information. It turns out that eigenvalues relate to entropy and information. Okay? And it turns out, and this is really cool, the error in approximating the original variables by a subset. If this was original 12 dimensions, I reduce it to 2. What's the error? It's the sum of the eigenvalues of the eigenvectors I didn't use. So if I had, if I just used the first 2, threw away these 10, if I summed up eigenvector 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, that's my error. That's actually really neat. Let's do an example, because you're going to say, I still don't know what he's talking about. Here are 6 images. Now let me turn the lights out for this one, because you want to see the detail in these images. Okay, and these are taken with different colors from an airplane flying over, probably doing crop analysis, because Purdue is an agricultural university, and they do a lot of ag analysis. And these are taken with different colors. And there's good detail in every one of them. I mean, you can see the roads and stuff. These start to look suspiciously like infrared images. Okay, but we're We'll find out what they are in the next slide, but notice there's detail in every one of them. Here's what the wavelengths are. And in fact, if you take a look, we had three infrared bands and three basically invisible. Now, we do the analysis that I just talked about. We've got the six different spectral images. We come up with a six-component vector for each corresponding pixel. So, you know, this would be, let's see, row 3, column 2. Actually, I guess instead of a 3, 2, it would be a 2, 1, okay, because I usually start at 0. Okay, and so that would be one random vector, move over, I get another random vector, move over, I get another. So for the entire image, okay, across the six spectral bands, I compute the mean vector, and I compute the covariance matrix. Then I compute the eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And here is what the eigenvectors are. And this is really interesting. If I represent the image by just this first vector transformation, notice it's 3,210. The next one is 931. And then it really drops up. 118. Okay. I don't know what the total is. That looks like about 4,200 total. I can get 3,200 over 4,200. That's at least a 75% accuracy. If I represent the first eigenvector in the transformation, if I include two, that's really representing effectively all of the information in the image. Now, what's interesting, so that you can get a feel for what these numbers mean, remember back here in the previous slide, I had actually... Let's suppose we do this. I want one slide earlier. Okay, let's suppose we do this. What do these pictures look like? You know, this is going to be a six vector. Component vector. Because this in this case is a six vector. So we compute our covariance matrix, we compute the eigenvectors, we compute the mean, and if you think about it, I'm going to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 images. Each one of them will correspond to this being multiplied by the transpose of the eigenvector. Okay, you don't have to remember all the math because this will be on the website. But what's interesting is what do those individual six images that correspond to these six eigenvalues look like? And this is what they look like. This is the first component image. This corresponds to eigenvector 1. You can see, that's got a lot of detail. It's got the roads. It's got a lot of information in it. We go to the second one. It's still got a lot of information. You can still see shape, texture, etc. What do you see in the next four? Not very much. The principle that you should walk away from this lecture with about these is that eigenvector 1 represented most of the information in the image. And by the way, whatever that combination, if we were just used, well, technically it's a color. You know, we started with six different colors, 3 in the infrared, 3 in the visible. If it were just even RGB, this is an analysis that you could use, for example, if you're looking at all of your lane markers. You could figure out, okay, here's all of my lane markers from images. What color principally corresponds to lane markers? This is a nice analytical way to do things like that. very impressive, but it lets you throw away stuff. It's sort of like a discrete cosine transform. This is a technique that was used, for example, for face analysis. Item face, very common. Now, you can apply it to boundaries. You don't have to just apply it to the whole image. Take the boundary and do, you know, just like we did before, an analysis. And this, by the way, I think is a lot of computation for not much return. It can tell you the principal axis. For example, the main body of the plane and the axis of the wing. You can do a lot of things with that. More types of chain codes and rules. You can represent a lot of geometries with chain codes. This, by the way, that's useful more for generation, I think, than recognition. Okay? This actually gets into what we were talking about earlier in representing boundaries. You can just simply represent boundaries of objects by, for example, line segments of constant length. So, for example, they're all the same length. I just fit them to the object. And the angle of each one of these now, just the angle. I've got a vector of angles that actually gives me the information about the shape of the object. There's all kinds of cool, simple ways of doing these things. You can get into fairly complicated objects that you can build. Actually, that wasn't supposed to do that. And you can get into topology, where you basically, for example, we have a starting object. Actually, it's usually all of space. Then we have an connected object A in it. It's got a connected object D inside it. And you can, this is the kind of stuff I do, where you do connected graph analysis or tree of objects. Now, we're going to do a tiny bit of chapter 12, because this also relates to how do you tell objects apart. This is a very, very classic study done in Science magazine, or maybe it was Nature, I can't remember. Every pattern recognition course refers to it. These are the flowers, irises, and they measure the width of the flower petal and the length of the flower petal. Three different types of irises here. And you plot them. And if you look carefully, there's a whole bunch of zeros down here which correspond to the iris serosa. And then if you look in here, there's a lot of the squares, which are the versicolor, and the triangles, which are the virginicum. The big thing is, if I look at this so-called pattern space, if I just measure the petal length and width, and I look at that, I can use that to tell at least the setosa. Just that measure works. You know, if you had a multidimensional plot of features for your stop signs, this would be a way to do it. You know, maybe on one axis we have the perimeter. Maybe on another axis we might have how close it is to a prototype red. We might have other things on different axes. This is what you want to do. This is cluster analysis. And it didn't start with neural nets. It started with pattern recognition. Here, we have overlapping sets. You see there's stuff down here, there's stuff up there. These are difficult to separate. You need different features to separate those. Noisy object. You can have noise in signatures. More of those. Trees we talked about. I want to mention these. Decision rules. The classic way that we do feature recognition and pattern recognition is if this were all red stop signs, maybe, and this were all other stop signs or traffic lights or whatever, okay, typically what you do is you take the average of all of these and the average of all of these, and that's what the black dots are. And a typical way for you to classify something is to come in and say, okay, if I have some unknown shape and I want to classify it, I'm going to pick the one that it's closest to. I compute the Euclidean distance from what I just measured to one of the prototypes, to the other prototypes. Whichever one is closest is what it should be. That makes perfect sense. If it's down here with these irises, okay, it'll be the serosa. If it's up there, it'll be all the others. So you can make decision rules for classifying. Now, you can really cheat. This is a man-made feature system. These are the numbers on your checkbooks. And it turns out they're magnetic ink. Okay? It's not done optically. It's done magnetically. And they go past, the head that reads the entire vertical. Okay? So basically, this character is moving past a reader. And what you do is you get a signal which corresponds to the derivative. Okay? And the reason you get a derivative is because we're sensing a magnetic field with a coil. I'm not going to get into that. But you always have LVIDTs. Okay? But basically, you see derivatives as you go along. The whole idea is, how can you recognize these apart? You know, when you're going to start, you measure the electrical signal as this head moves along. And you notice that these shapes are defined precisely so that the peaks occur. You notice that the grid lines, you sample the grid lines. So, for example, as I'm moving across the letter, I make one sample, okay, and I do that like 10 times, and what I do then is that's a vector of 10 numbers. All zeros will have a pattern that looks like that. All nines will have a pattern that looks like that, and I have no idea what these patterns are called, okay? They're just used to register and identify things. So, I will say that correlation is not usually a very good thing. You notice that I've been stressing scale, rotation, translation. Correlation works if you exactly know what your object looks like and it doesn't vary. And correlation can work very well. You can see that, for example, we're correlating here to find a D. And it's fairly reasonable, but you get fairly good responses also for B's and E's and F's and even a C. Correlation is not the best, and it's the most computationally expensive. And I probably won't do any of this because it gets into neural nets, and that's 484. So that's going to be the end of the course, except for your papers. And what I'm going to do, I'm still grading, I will scan them and email them to each of you as PDFs. And you'll be able to pick up the originals from me. And since I have nothing else to do now but grade your papers, I think that will happen fairly quickly. And since the weather is so crummy out tonight, that's usually very good. The only bad thing is there is a Browns game on tonight against Pittsburgh. And Cleveland for any length of time. It's interesting. So, it's been a very interesting semester. I look forward to some really good final reports, final papers, and you'll be getting your papers. Yes. If you want to go over 6 pages, talk to me. When you go over on real conferences, what was the last page charge you had? Probably $200 or $300 a page.
Up to two extra pages.
At that point, they absolutely truncate it. So let's put it this way. The value added should be very good. And I will tell you, the most important thing that I observed in your midterm papers, the better your references, which meant that you actually looked at what other people did and simply implemented variants of what they did applied to your problem, the better your project was. I'm not penalizing you for copying what someone else did, if that person isn't in this class, of course. Okay. But there's some very good published work done. It may not exactly be for stop signs or traffic lanes, but it could be very close. And it, you know, lots of people have done a lot of things. Just read it a little bit, and I assure you, quality of your papers will go up. Quality of your results will go up. One thing that you learn from papers is what didn't work. Okay, and that's also why I put all of your papers for midterm out there. Anyone have any problems opening the midterm papers? And with fixtures? Yes, yes. And I checked with Scott, and apparently he did use one that may have been a little bit earlier. And I haven't checked because I have mine at home. I don't know which one I had.
I think I sent the wrong mail.
Okay. Well, don't worry about it. Okay. Well, don't worry.
I sent the latest one.
Okay. You see, the interesting stuff in chapters 11, 10, and 12. Which is natural.
Right. I mean, using the
that's where it should be.
The clown analogy from that, mm-hmm. And then reproducing it again, and then noticing how it drops.
Yes. 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 But actually, it gets into, you know, this whole issue that they've been doing called eigenface analysis. And for example, if I took a picture of everyone's face in the class, what is the it's not so much what's the average. What's the face shape that contains the most information? That's a subtle difference on average. Well, and I always enjoyed that because I originally learned in optics and how it was implemented optically. You know, optical 2D Fourier transforms, all of that stuff. It was pretty amazing. But it's very neat. Okay. So, John, you're going to rush out there and work. And if you, particularly the guys from industry, give me a little bit extra time. Well, it depends on whether you want to grade before Christmas. Oh, how about a 40-hour-a-week job? Or, depending on how you do it, a wife that tells you when you have time to work on your project. Well, I know. The wives can be coerced. Although, it's probably closer to the truth. Do-do?